Guardian Unlimited.
Hello and welcome along to the Guardian Haycast. I'm Safraz Manzor with your guide to the Hay Festival. Now, it has been something of a glorious day in Hay today. The sun's been blazing, the ice cream sellers have been enjoying a roaring trade. And some impressive names to entertain festival goers today: Graham Swift, William Hague, David Attenborough, to name just three. On today's Haycast, Doris Lessing, one of the most important post-war writers in English, the legendary cartoonist Quentin Blake, and I'll be finding out what's making these young kids make this sound.
Moshpit!
All will be explained later, but first, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie burst onto the literary scene in 2003, aged just 25, with her debut novel, Purple Hibiscus, which was shortlisted for the Orange Prize. Now her second novel, Half of a Yellow Sun, confirms her as one of the finest young authors writing today, and it's currently the favourite to win this year's Orange Prize. Guardian Unlimited's books editor Sarah Crown spoke to Chimamanda, and she started by asking her what drove her to write the book.
I was driven by so many things. I have for so long been obsessed with what happened because my parents lived through it.
Right.
And I think also just knowing that the reason I didn't know my grandfathers is because they had died in the war. And you know, I wrote poetry about the war, all of which were bad poems. I wrote dramas. I mean, I, for so long I've been interested in this. I read a lot about the war. And I knew that I would write a novel. I was just waiting to be ready, you know, sort of to be emotionally ready. And,
yeah.
And I thought when I finished Purple Hibiscus that I would try. And yeah. So it's so difficult to talk about what drove me as though it were a single thing. It's really, I think it's a book that I was meant to write. And I don't mean to sound, you know, horribly mystical about things, but I really feel that it's a book I was meant to write, that I had to write it.
And so did your parents talk to you a lot when you were younger about the war?
They talked about their fathers who had died. They talked about, my mother would say, oh, I used to have a beautiful plate like that one in the store, but I'd lost it in the war. But they never really talked about, you know, what had happened exactly, why the war had happened, how they fled, until I was a bit older and I started to ask questions, and then they started to, you know, really talk about it. And so when I was younger, the war was, you know, the reason my mother didn't have her beautiful wig, you know, the reason my father didn't have his graduating gown from the University of California where he got his PhD.
That's so it was thing. You first felt it in material losses,
yeah.
Then
but also no people. But spiritual losses as well, as you know, that my grandfathers had died, that in some ways I feel that our memories also as a family, the collective memories of my family, had been divided, because my father would talk about something sometimes and then stop and say, oh, that was before the war. And it made me wonder, well, what if the war hadn't happened? What would our trajectories have been? You know, what would have happened to us?
Mm. Yeah. And how has the book been received in Nigeria?
It's to my surprise, because my Nigerian publisher said, you know, you have to be ready. They're going to really blast you, because it's still such a controversial, such a fraught thing. And I really have been pleasantly surprised, because it seems that people are interested in reading about this period. And because it's, you know, we don't talk about the war. We don't learn about the war in school. It's a part of our history that we don't really acknowledge.
Right.
And so I realized when I was writing it that for a lot of Nigerians, this book would be the first introduction to that history. And it's actually turning out much better than I thought. I mean, people haven't thrown stones at me or anything yet. I have received a number of emails, you know, angry emails, like, why won't you let things be? It's in the past, let it go. But most of the emails have been, you know, thank you for writing about this period. Finally, I have an opportunity to talk to my mother about what she went through, that sort of thing. So I've, you know, and I hear that reviews have been good. I don't read reviews to keep myself sane.
It's a grand novel for people who haven't read it. It covers a sweep of history. It moves backwards and forwards in time. It has a large cast of characters. And as well as working on the grand scale, it works very intimately as well. So you come to know the central characters incredibly closely. And although it's obviously very deeply grounded in Nigeria and Biafra, it really reminded me, as I was reading it, of sort of European 19th century novels, Eliot and Dickens, where you have that sweep of time and humanity. And you have one of your characters, in fact, Ugwu, in the book. I think I see him reading at one point The Mayor of Casterbridge, I think. And I wondered whether those books had, whether you'd drawn from that tradition of writing. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting, not consciously, but I must have, because it's the kind of fiction I like. I love a good story. I love language. I love characters. And I grew up reading books of that sort. I was a keen Charles Dickens fan. I love Dickens. I mean, now, not sure about now, but I should go back and read Dickens, actually. But I read, you know, I read The Merchant of Caster Bridge. I read, I also quite like Balzac. So, you know, but I, again, about influence, I think I'm influenced by everything I've read, really. You know, I don't think that it's a conscious thing where I sit down and think, all right, now I will do a 19th century. But I do think that my sensibility towards literature is very sort of old-fashioned.
Obviously, the novel is about the war. But there are moments in it when you can completely forget, particularly in the sort of in the first, you know, it's set in the early 60s and in the late 60s. When you're in the early 60s, it's a domestic drama, really. It's about family and love and sibling rivalry and desire and passion.
I think, you know, when I was writing it, I also remember constantly reminding myself, particularly when I would discover something new in my research and think, I have to use this. But then I would remind myself, you know, in the end, I want this to be about human beings, about character, not about war. You know, and also to just remind myself and my readers that these people who are reduced by war actually did have normal, ordinary lives, you know, at some point when they cared about what are we having for dinner, who's sleeping with whom, you know, who do I want to sleep with, that sort of thing. And I think it's important because sometimes, and particularly for Africa, I think, at a time when we're seen in sort of as a place where war happens and people starve to death and AIDS is killing everybody, and we rarely see the ordinary African who's just living and loving and laughing. And I thought it was important to juxtapose both, to say that Africa is a place where terrible things happen, unfortunately, but it's not just that. It's also...
Yes, a place where people live.
Yes.
And people are the same.
Yes, absolutely.
The world over.
Yes.
Yeah. I wondered why, slightly... connected to that point, you chose to include the character of Richard, who is the white expat Englishman who moves over to Nigeria and becomes completely caught up in this cause in this country, which isn't strictly speaking his.
Yeah. Why did I have that Englishman? I just wanted to make the book easier to be published in England. No, I'm joking. I wanted very much to have the English point of view because I do think that this war wouldn't have happened the way it happened, wouldn't have ended the way it ended if Britain hadn't been involved. And I wanted to have that. I wanted to have the outsider. But I wanted to turn it around as well, because sort of the English, the idea of the English person in Biafra at the time was that, you know, the English was very keen to destroy Biafra, the English supported Nigeria. And so I thought I would turn it around. And, you know, in some ways I felt also that Richard's pro-Biafran-ness, Richard's whiteness and the privilege of his race. So being a Biafran of sorts, but then being white meant that he could tell the story to the world in a way that a black Biafran couldn't. And I thought that was important because I do think that the way the war was reported, you know, that it was often from a particular point of view that you often didn't get the black Biafran voice telling the story of the war.
So do you think, on that note, that you will continue to write about Nigeria or might you set your next novel somewhere else?
You know, I think wherever I set it, it will be about Nigeria, because really Nigeria is the only place I know. I think that because I grew up in Nigeria, because my thinking is Nigerian, I want to write about Nigerians in America, maybe Nigerians in England, maybe. But it will be Nigerian in that sort of, the sensibility will be Nigerian, but the settings might be different, because I am interested in diaspora and what it means for Africans to live outside of Africa and retain Africanness. And it's a very strange, complex thing.
Hello, I'm Ian Rankin, and you're listening to The Guardian's Haycast.
Guardian's Haycast.
Now, possibly the hardest working people at the festival, the Haycast team excepted, of course, are the shuttle bus drivers who ferry festival goers to and from Haytown Centre to the festival site, which is about a mile away. The buses leave every 15 minutes from outside the site entrance, and for the princely sum of only £1, you can travel as many times as you like. We took the shuttle bus and asked its driver how the festival's been for them.
12 o'clock, wasn't it? 12 past 12, I think we started Thursday. All day Thursday, all day Friday. Yeah, I've done every day. Some people you get on are really chatty, quite happy to get on and have a talk. You get them and it makes it go quicker.
A ticket?
Yeah.
Sunday or Monday, everyone seemed to be real, I don't know. Because it was raining, I suppose, it was a hard day.
I wasn't quite sure how far it was.
but it is quite a long way.
They come very often, yeah.
I can walk for miles, but I don't want to keep walking this distance all the time between the town and the... So the shuttle buses are really perfect, and the people who drive them are very good. I have noticed how courteous they are. They will stop and be patient, see the stragglers, let them get on. So really, it is absolutely essential.
So come on out of the rain, we're just having a chat here.
The other night, I was sat down here, it was quiet. In between events or something, I was having a cup of coffee and someone walked up and said, oh, coffee, smell of coffee, I haven't had decent coffee all day. Well, here's the other half of the cup, you have it. Like, and we sat down and we had a joke and it made that half hour or 20 minutes or whatever the time was go really quick, and that's what you want as a driver.
Now, Quentin Blake is one of Britain's best-loved illustrators. He started out at 16, sketching for Punch magazine, and he's illustrated over 300 books. He's probably most famous, though, for his illustrations for the books of Roald Dahl. Nell Bowes met Quentin Blake and asked him about his collaborations.
The important thing is it begins with the text, really. I mean, you have the words in front of you, and you start collaborating with them. If you know something about the writer, of course, that helps. But you work from that, and then you work with the book, and then you really want to go back and check it out with the author. And I mean, I did that very much with Roald Dahl, and I used to take my first drawings of what I thought the characters looked like down to Great Missenden and talk to him about it. And I mean, on the whole, he was very nice about it. At one point he said, Quent always gets it right. Michael Rosen I've known for a long time, and I did his first book of poetry 25 years ago or something like that. And when he was asked this question, he very nicely said, I just give it to Quentin, he gets on with it. And he is also a wonderful collaborator, because when we were doing poems, I mean, his poems, he gave me some subjects for poems which he hadn't written yet. So there were some drawings in the book for which the poems didn't exist. And then there were some poems which really one couldn't illustrate, or at least one couldn't help by illustrating them. So it was a rather nice way of doing it. But we don't know each other tremendously well as friends or anything, I mean socially, but we know each other's backgrounds and we have a certain amount of educational background in common. And so I think there's a sort of rapport there.
That's interesting. Was it, I mean, if you're not that close, what was it like writing the Sad Book, which was an illustration of Michael Rosen's grief at the death of his son? Was it difficult to work with someone who was grief-stricken?
No, the great advantage there was that I knew Mike Rosen, and in a way, I have to confess it was an advantage, although very strangely, I'd drawn his son as a character in his poems when he was quite small. But in a way, it was a relief to me that I had never met him. So that I wasn't, in a sense, I knew Mike, so I was sort of involved in it, but I wasn't involved in it so much that I couldn't have a slightly detached point of view of it. And the interesting professional problem, in a sense, there was to organise the book so that it was grey and morning and sunny and cheerful at times, you know, and to sort of play between those two things. It is there, but I mean, it's all there in the text. It's a very short text, but it's all there if you look at it. You know.
I wanted to ask you about birds, really.
Yes.
Given the life of birds and given that, one of the things that made a huge impression on me as a child was the roly-poly bird descending.
Oh, yes.
And I wondered if there was something particularly that fascinated you about them.
Am I allowed to draw birds?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Well, I've never been quite sure, but I think I've said, and I don't know whether it's true or not, that they're more like people because they're on two legs. But birds, I think you can, because they've got two legs, I mean, seem to have the sort of movements of people, and that's how I think. I'm just drawing one now, if you can hear the scratch, but in a way, the idea of the life of birds, that book, it's not, it's a book without a story. In fact, it's they're sort of portraits of people, really, but it's a way of drawing a type of person without drawing a caricature of an individual.
Someone mentioned that you were thinking about setting up a museum of illustration.
Yes.
And such a thing doesn't exist at the moment in Britain.
It doesn't really exist, no. I mean, the great museums have huge holdings of illustration. There is no museum of illustration, and yet it's a great British tradition. And what we want to do is, I mean, we've been working on it for 3 or 4 years, and I think we're getting somewhere now, but the important thing is to find a suitable home for it, which we may be in sight of. And when we are assured that we have got a home, then, of course, we have to raise a lot of money. But it'll be an exhibition area where there will be contemporary art, there will be the work of publishers, there will be exhibitions showing how illustration is done and how it's printed. There will be exhibitions of the history of illustration, which a lot of people don't know about. You know, there's huge amounts of illustration which exist still in museums, but not on view.
We wondered if... Is there any chance you might be able to draw a podcast for us?
Well, here are some ears.
It's the BFG.
Well, not quite.
Yes, almost.
Yeah. You won't be able to tell from this drawing exactly what he's listening to. Although I have no idea what it is.
Hi, I'm Sebastian Folkes.
I'm Dave Eggers, and you're listening
to Richard Dawkins, and you're listening to The Guardians.
And you're listening to The Guardians Haycast.
Now, as well as the Hay Book Festival, there is also the Hay Fringe, and these are events and happenings that are taking place in the streets and venues in the heart of Hay. We've got live music, dancing, poetry, stand-up comedy, films, open mic, and also theatre. For example, the Red Kite Theatre, and the person in charge of that is Margie Douglas. Now, tell me a little bit about what the Red Kite Theatre is, Margie.
Red Kite Theatre is Hay's very own local community theatre. We're predominantly a youth theatre, but we're actually open to all ages.
Where are we? We're just behind the castle, aren't we, in the centre of Hay?
We're in Hay Castle grounds, and this is where most of the Fringe Festival is taking place. There's lots of open-air activities going on here, and today we're going to do some street theatre.
Now, all around me I'm seeing, there must be about a couple of dozen young people. Most of them seem to be dressed in a slightly ominous black. What sort of performances do you put on?
Yeah, well, they all dress in an ominous black most of the time, because last year we actually did a show called The Gothic Carnival, and this actually seemed to have had a rather lasting impact on them all. But they've come up with some really interesting ideas, which were a base. Well, we started off with the idea of talking about the history of Hay, and there was a book about things that had happened in and, you know, had gone on in Hay. And we said, well, you know, could you come up, base some street theatre performances on things that have happened? And one of the things that they chose was the murder of someone called Mrs. Armstrong. It's a quite very, very famous case.
And this is what we're going to be seeing in a few seconds.
This is what we're going to be starting off with.
Murder! Murder! Murder at Hay on Wye!
Oh no, she's gone again.
Well, that might work.
Mrs. Armstrong is dead!
Yes, I gathered that.
Murdered by her husband, Mr. Armstrong.
Yes.
He put arsenic in her cooking, went down the pub and left her to die.
Oh, that's awful.
I know. Mm-hmm. Right old bag she was too.
Do you mind if I leave that out?
Yes, whatever.
Okay. Right, so what happened to Mr. Armstrong?
Oh, they hung him.
They did what?
Well, they hung him. Murder. You know, the penalty is death. The police hung him yesterday.
The police?
The police? Who else hangs people, dear?
So tell me a little bit about this performance that I just had a look at now.
It's the history of Hay. So there was a murder in Hay on Wye 83 years ago about Mrs. Armstrong. And the other one we did about the words was just exploring, shouting out words. It's great fun.
And the murder one sounds like quite a dark subject. What did you like about it?
The fact that it's like part of local history, actually.
And in terms of performances, you do like short ones, but there's quite a lot of different ones, is that right? How many are there?
There's a few. We've been working on different like sketches and things through the sessions on Fridays.
What are they all doing in the back there? They're making shapes.
They're doing about travelling. It's about exploring trains, so at the moment they're pretending to be on an aeroplane.
Why has that boy got green hair?
We want to attract as much attention as possible.
Finally on today's Haycast, Doris Lessing. She's one of the most celebrated writers living today. Now 87, she is perhaps most famous for her novel The Golden Notebook, which is considered a feminist classic by many. Her latest novel, The Cleft, imagines a society populated only with women, or clefts, as they're known, until suddenly a male, or squirt, as they're referred to in the book, is born and their idyllic world is forever changed. Our very own squirt, Zan Brooks, met up with Doris Lessing earlier, and he began by asking her what inspired the ideas in the novel.
Round about 2 or 3 years ago, there was this idea that the basic human stock had been female and men came along after, and that really inspired me, the whole idea. I thought, first it seems to me perfectly obvious it must be so, which, but...
Why obvious?
Well, because women are sort of, I think, women are sort of settled and seated and they have a very good relationship with the universe. Well, I don't think men do. I think you're a thoroughly unsettled lot still.
and a naturally younger lot.
Well, they're much more like a younger species than... I mean, this is what's... I'm not saying this is good or bad, you understand. Mm. I just think that this is why women tend to be conservative on the whole and... Well, they're very practical. I mean, you know, I can go on like this for hours. I'm sure anybody else on the scene could do the same. It is a natural idea, isn't it, that that women are... I mean, we are very, very different, aren't we? Men and women are totally different. And there's no good pretending we're not.
But you've enraged a lot of people by saying that with this book, that people are kind of accusing you of peddling sort of gender stereotypes.
Oh, well, I mean, if you're going to have a whole lot of... females sitting on the same seashore for thousands of years, they're bound to be rather slack and slow, like sloths, it seems to me. They need to be woken up a bit.
Do you see yourself as a basically conservative, settled person?
No.
Right. So you're the exception to the...
I didn't say all women are. I'm talking about then, if these women, the basic human stock, were living on their seashore for thousands of years with nothing ever happening to them, there was no surprises. They didn't have to worry about food. They didn't have to worry about the climate. It was a good climate. Suddenly, a baby boy appears. This must have been very unsettling to them. Mm. And very good for them, because it would shake them up a bit.
Mm. So men are there to shake women up a bit?
I didn't say that. But they do. My feeling is that if this is true, evolution or whatever this person is, or creature or force, that causes things to happen, decided that men would be a good idea and bring in a new kind of freshness and excitement.
I'm glad that you say that you don't see yourself as conservative, because looking back over your life, from your upbringing in Africa to coming to London, you seem to have led a very restless, very adventurous, very independent life. Is that how you see it yourself?
I don't think I'm... Look, when I say that women are basically conservative, I'm not saying that every woman in the world is basically conservative. I think, as a tendency, I think that women are more settled and more conservative than men. I'm not talking politically, I'm talking about... That's what I think. And about the whole... I don't know why people get so upset so easily. Well, it's... First, people don't like words very often. They get upset by words like cleft and squirt and monsters. They get upset by words, which is quite extraordinary. They get upset by ideas.
Why is that extraordinary? For someone who has dealt in words all your life and knows the power of words probably better than practically anybody, why is it surprising that people would react to words?
Because they react sometimes surprisingly. The word cleft, which after all comes from Queen Elizabeth I, is easy to tolerate after a bit. The whole idea of the language I use about men tend to upset them, and not all of them. It was, you're always going to these generalizations. About the whole idea of the women on that time, of that kind, on that place, being very slow and lazy, I don't see that. I've said that this is what women are always like, everywhere, at any time. Mm. It's just then.
When you come to events like this, I guess you get told endlessly by people how much your work has changed their lives and how much the Golden Notebook or the Shikasta series has changed their lives. How has it changed your life? How has writing changed your life? And what has it kind of given to you personally?
Everything. Because you can't write a book without getting new ideas and new thoughts. I mean, this is one of the pleasures of writing. If you start a new book, one thing I think is, I'm going to be completely different at the end of it because I'll have all these new ideas and thoughts, which is true.
And because when you were in your early 20s, you were kind of married, you had two children, and then you kind of threw that all into to sort of chase after writing. That was what you did.
I gave it all up. At that time, I was a communist. Everybody was a communist in those days. I was the great new utopias that I was in love with. What idiots we were.
But isn't writing about achieving a certain utopia?
No.
It's not. It's not about questing after something.
No. It's something for somebody like me. It's something I have to do. I have to do it. I mean, otherwise I would go crazy. I mean, I think this is probably a very neurotic thing that I'm saying about myself. I cannot not write. That means that, something must be wrong with me.
So you have no plans to stop writing? You can't conceive of a life now without writing?
Not easily, no. No. Okay. Why should I?
Doris Lessing, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, that's all from today's Haycast. One more show to go, and remember, if you have missed any of the other Haycasts, you can listen to them all at books.guardian.co.uk/hay2007/haycast, and you can follow the Hay coverage online at guardian.co.uk/books/hay2007, and of course in the paper as well. With it being the last Haycast tomorrow, we'll be looking back at the last 10 days. I'm Safraz Manzoor, and the programme was produced by Francesca Panetta and Phil Maynard. Until tomorrow, it's goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.